For the past 3 years, the Science of Reading Star Awards have honored educators who are beacons of light, guiding their classrooms, schools, districts, and most importantly, students through transformations with literacy. Now join us as we honor this year's winners at a special celebration event, which will feature celebrity keynoters and past podcast guests. Mitchell Brookins.
2 years ago, one of my students as a school administrator came to me on the playground and he said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to be like the other kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Mr. Brookins, I want to learn how to read."
And Malcolm Mitchell.
When I scored a touchdown, they either probably put my name in a newspaper. People probably tell me good job all around town. But when I finished one book, no one ever said anything. So which one am I more likely to repeat?
Find out more information and register for the 2024 Science of Reading Star Awards Ceremony at amplify.com/Star Awards Celebrations. That's amplify.com/Star Awards Celebration. All one word.
How do we help students become confident readers? What meaningful conversations should we have to overcome barriers to equity and inclusivity in the classroom? Welcome to Season 4 of Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. This season, we're exploring important topics that impact our students every day: reading acceleration and recovery, inclusivity, and meeting students just where they're at on their reading journey. We've lined up an amazing team of experts who will inspire you as they share their perspectives to find fresh ways to help you support your students. This season, we're also honoring educators who have driven change in their district by successfully implementing the Science of Reading. You'll hear from winners of the Amplify Science of Reading Star Awards as they share their experiences fighting for students when no one else would. The Science of Reading movement continues to grow, and as educators, we will continue to grow with it. It's vital that we focus on research-based practices to deliver classroom instruction that allows students to learn. The more we learn and listen, the more we'll be prepared to lead. Our students are counting on us. I am thrilled for today's episode, which features Dr. Nadine Gabb. Her work is at the intersection of neuroscience, education, edtech, and policy. She has and is engaged in longitudinal research studying the language and reading development from birth through the elementary school years to better understand typical and atypical learning trajectories. Currently an associate professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, we are lucky to hear from her and hear her point of view on what we know and what we still need to learn as we think about developing proficient readers. Enjoy. Welcome. We're so glad to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, on this podcast, we always like to start by having our listeners really understand professional journey. So we'd love to hear your professional journey. How did you become so deeply interested in early reading?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of an unconventional story, I think. So I did my doctoral work in the area of sound processing in the brain. And I was really interested in how professional musicians process sounds differently and what kind of brain areas may be different in these, you know, professional sound processors or professional musicians. And after finishing this, I really was looking for a more applied connection of my work. And I was looking into some differences or disorders related to auditory processing or sound processing. And at the time, there was a prominent theory that reading disabilities may be caused by auditory processing difficulties. And so that's how I sort of went into the field and learned more and then became really interested in reading in general and the role of development over time and the brain in learning to read and especially in atypical reading development.
Wow, that's a really interesting journey. I'm sure our listeners wouldn't associate you with music and the auditory
pieces of musician. So most our listeners know your work from actually dyslexia. And we would love for you to talk just a little bit about that, what dyslexia is and how it's diagnosed.
Yeah, sure. So I want to start with describing a little bit of, you know, what are the important components of learning to read.
Oh, I'd love that.
So if you think about reading development as a journey, often people think about when does actually reading development start? And if you ask many different people, when does reading development start? You often hear, you know, a variety of answers like, oh, maybe the first day of kindergarten, or maybe when I start introducing letters to these children, or maybe when they start, you know, tapping the letters on the iPad. But if you think about it, reading development starts in utero because the fundamental milestones for learning to read are sound and language processing. And so that's where I come from, right? The sound processing part. Yeah. And these start as early as in utero. And if you then look at the journey, the first four and a half years of learning to read are actually oral language development, right? So we need to know, once we can read, you know, what is the meaning of the word? And we need to know how the end of a sentence we read connects to the beginning of the sentence that we read, or how the end of a text connects to the beginning of the text. So you can see how the oral language piece is really important. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you need to be able to decode the word, right? And so I call this the mechanics of reading. And so for that, it's really important to have like an ability to manipulate the sounds of language, the phonological or phonemic awareness, the ability to map the sounds of language onto the written counterparts, the letters, right? And then being able to, you know, go from the letter by letter reading in the recognition of the word as a whole, like more of a sight word recognition. And in sight words, I'm meaning like words that you just recognize by sight. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you think about these two components, like everyone knows probably the Hollis-Scarborough rope, you have the mechanics of reading where we really talk about how do we actually decode a word. And then you have that oral language piece. And there's many other pieces that feed into this. But if you think about dyslexia, the way we see it as an umbrella of reading disability. And under the umbrella is dyslexia and other, you know, reading disabilities. And if you think about the rope, you then want to look at the mechanics piece as being the one that is dyslexia. So it's a deficit in single word reading, and an original primary deficit in single word reading. It can eventually lead to problems with reading fluency and reading comprehension, but mm-hmm. the core deficit initially is an ability to decode a single word, you know, especially a non-word, or, you know, like this mapping of sounds onto the letters and blending those together to decoding the word. So to answer your question, dyslexia is this, you know, inability to become automatic in the mechanics of reading, but you can have many other, you know, problems with reading that are not related to the mechanics, but more related maybe to, you know, an oral language piece or other components related.
That makes a lot of sense and perfectly aligns with many of the topics we've talked about on this podcast before. And when it comes to dyslexia, I think there's quite a few myths, and we'll talk about some of them, but one of them is that you either have it or don't, right? So it's a little more complex than just a yes, no proposition. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's more like a continuum. So it's not like, you know, a genetic test or brain scan that you can do and you can see like, oh, this child has dyslexia and this other child doesn't. And I think it's also in the wrong question, right? So we want to find everyone who is struggling with learning to read, because reading is such a fundamental skill in our society, or in most societies, that we want to make sure that we find everyone who is struggling with learning to read and make sure that everyone has a joy of learning to read or experience the joy of learning to read. And so it's more of a continuum than like a black white kind of a spectrum. There's a lot of things that dyslexia is not, right? So it's not like explained by poor vision or explained by like lack of motivation, or if you have, a hearing impairment, or if you never, got good reading instruction, or if you never, were taught how to read, then, if you struggle out of these reasons, that's not developmental dyslexia. So developmental dyslexia is really a specific learning disability. And if you think about the DSM, five that was released in 2013, it defines, a neurodevelopmental disorder, so a specific learning disorder, as a group of conditions with onset in the developmental period that results in impairment in personal and social, academic, or occupational functioning. Right. And so that's really important because that just shows, the developmental origin of, a specific learning disorder, but also that, multifactorial kind of etiology.
What do you mean by multifactorial?
So what I mean by this is that, for the longest time, people thought there may be one cause, right, of atypical reading development or one cause of dyslexia. And so there have been like all these, studies looking at this one thing in the brain or this one, skill. But it's a combination of a variety of things that are interacting with each other. So there's genetics, right? There is the brain, there's perception, cognition, and there is the environment. There's these complex interactions between these that can lead to atypical reading development or, can lead to, developmental dyslexia. And so when we talk about these factors, we also have to think about the protective factors. So things can be risk factors, but they can also be protective factors. And so it's a very complex etiology of these different factors, both risk factors as well as protective factors.
Let's talk a little bit about on the risk side. So I'm going to take just a tiny step back and say, you've been involved in a lot of longitudinal research, starting when children are babies and sort of following them over time. What have you learned in that, in sort of that process of your longitudinal research as it relates to either risk or protection, I guess, of reading difficulties?
Yeah, so we do a lot of work where we are interested in developmental trajectories, right? So instead of just, taking one point in time and looking at like the brain or the behavior or the reading skill of a group of children compared to another group of children or individuals, we are more interested in the development of skills and the development of language, pre-reading, reading skills, development of the brain and how they all relate to each other and what's the role of the environment in those. So a lot of the work we do is follow kids over many, many years and then see, what are their trajectories in terms of development of these skills as well as the brain, and when does the trajectories diverge between the children who subsequently struggle with learning to read versus the ones who are not struggling with learning to read. And so what we could show is that some of the brain alterations that many different research labs have reported for individuals who struggle with learning to read versus their peers seem to be present prior to the first start of formal reading instruction. So these kids step into the first day of kindergarten or first grade with a less optimal brain for learning to read. And so that really is the core argument for finding these kids early, right? So for the longest time, we didn't know, do they have maybe a different brain because they're struggling on a daily basis, or do they come into the classroom with some of these, you know, brain alterations that make it more difficult to learn mm-hmm. to read? And it seems to be a combination of the two, but there's definitely some aspects that are there prior to learning to read. In terms of the behavior, many, many different research studies, not just us and many, you know, many years before us, have identified phonological awareness, so the ability to manipulate the sounds of language, as one of the early behavioral predictors. For phonological or phonemic awareness, it's important to keep in mind that it's a developmental trajectory, right? So it's not like black white, like you either have mm-hmm. it or not, but it mm-hmm. starts with rhyming and then, you know, matching first sounds, you know, taking away sounds, adding sounds, etc. Another big behavioral predictor is pseudo word repetition, where you give a made up word to the child and ask the child to repeat it back. And you want to make sure that this made up word somehow falls into the rules of the language that the child is learning to read in. So, for instance, in English, as well as rapid automatized naming, which is a predictor of reading fluency, can often just give you an idea of like general automaticity and retrieval speed of a child. And then the other three important pieces, as early predictors are letter knowledge and letter sound knowledge, as well as this oral piece, oral language piece that we discussed that, develops in this first 4 or 5 years of life before even the first day of reading instruction. And that's like vocabulary as well as oral listening comprehension.
We'll be right back.
Greetings, everyone, at Amplify, the Science of Reading. My name is Leanna Malinowski. Thank you very much for the opportunity to audition to be on the podcast. When I saw the advertisement on social media, my heart skipped a beat. I'm a 14-year veteran teacher, a certified reading specialist. I have Orton-Gillingham training that I use in my classroom every day, and I've also served as a Tier 3 teacher at my school. I listen to other podcasts, but I always default back to Amplify. I've learned so much about the science of reading by listening to the podcast. It's been a great supplement to my coursework, training, and my own personal professional development. Not to mention, it makes a great co-pilot carpool buddy on my way to and from school every day. It would be an honor to be on the podcast as a guest so I can share my experiences and talk about how the podcast is a great resource for all teachers to have in their teacher toolbox. After all, teaching is lifelong learning, and we're in this together. I'm looking forward to hearing from you soon. Bye for now.
And in terms of then, I would say formal diagnosis of dyslexia or any other reading challenges, we know, and we've talked a lot about on this podcast, that like that diagnosis tends to come late. So lots of us have had the experience that they've had a child or a student in maybe third grade or fourth grade, and that's when they've been diagnosed with dyslexia, when there is actually risk factors that could have been identified prior to that. Can you talk a little bit about like identifying the risk factors and why that's important versus the diagnosis necessarily of dyslexia?
Yeah, sure. So there's something that we call the dyslexia paradox, which is the discrepancy between we currently, diagnose dyslexia and give a child access to intensive intervention that they need, and the window for most effective intervention, right? So that discrepancy between the time when they get the diagnosis and the window for the most effective intervention is called the dyslexia paradox. And the window for the most effective intervention is like in kindergarten or first grade or even earlier, while, most kids don't get diagnosed. It's getting a little bit better, but for the longest time didn't get diagnosed till maybe third grade or later. And so mm-hmm. what we do know is that the earlier you diagnose, the earlier you identify children at risk, the better, the early interventions work. So there's much larger effect sizes in kindergarten and first grade than in, second and third grade. And we know that identifying children at risk early and providing them what they need you know, ideally within general education or tier one, will lead to, you know, better outcomes in these children. So it's often the question, why is the window for most effective intervention so much earlier? And at least it has, you know, two reasons. One is the brain is a lot more plastic for language the younger it is. So you can, you know, tell by knowing, you know, how easy it is to learn a second language or a third language when you're four versus when you're 40. And, you know, that, you know, the gap between, you know, the good reader and the poor reader in terms of vocabulary and background knowledge and et cetera widens, you know, day after day. And so it's really important to think more about like a preventive approach, so like almost like preventive education, which you can, you know, compare with preventive medicine, where we embrace preventive medicine. We ask, you know, can you find, you know, any markers that tell me whether I will develop health problems? And if so, what can we do now so I will never develop these health problems? And that's the same idea with here, where you want to identify children at risk for developing problems with reading. So you don't want to diagnose them, you know, in pre-K or, you know, in the first 6 weeks of kindergarten. You want to identify children at risk so that you can then, you know, intervene ideally again within general education, but some kids need more than that, with the ultimate goal that you have lower rates of dyslexia in the higher grades, or if someone still gets a diagnosis, that this is, you know, less severe because of the start of early intervention.
That makes sense. I'm just going to say for our listeners, sort of reiterate that we're really talking about first identifying really early those kids that are at risk for developing further problems, prevent that through really great instruction. And then, you know, so identification of risk and diagnosis are actually two different things. Am I hearing you right on that?
Yeah, and that's really important. Yeah, it's really important. So let's give the example of high cholesterol, right? So if you screen for high cholesterol, you don't, and yet say you have high cholesterol, you don't get a diagnosis of heart disease, right? So no, someone will tell you that you have a heightened risk to develop problems with your heart, or you have a heightened risk to develop heart disease. And then you want to start intervening right then preventively, right? So with exercise or diet or medicine. And the ultimate goal is that you never develop heart disease, or if you develop it, it's less severe. And so that's the same idea here. So the idea is not to diagnose dyslexia in four-year-old. The idea here is to have a preventive approach where we find the kids who will most likely struggle, help them so that they will never struggle.
And when we were having our conversation in the pre-call, you used a phrase that I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more about. You were really passionate in talking about this prevention model. And you said, I really want us to focus on prevention rather than being stuck in a reactive model. And you used that phrase, stuck in a reactive model. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. What I mean by this is that when it comes to learning differences, we are largely still focused on a reactive, deficit-driven, wait-to-fail model. So we are waiting till a child shows a problem, and then we are reacting to that problem instead of the development of preventive approaches or proactive approaches, where we are proactively finding the kids who will most likely struggle with learning to read and help them so that they will never struggle with learning to read.
And if you are a classroom teacher or in a school right now and saying, well, what can I use to help me find those kids that may be at risk? What suggestions would you give them?
Yeah, so there has been a really great movement in the last couple of years related to screening for reading disabilities. So there's lots of new legislation, some well-designed, some not so well-designed. And so there's been really great tools. So you can, for instance, go to the National Center for Improving Literacy and look at their tools chart. They can really help you to find a good screener that is, you know, evidence-based and has good validity and is reliable and has good classification accuracy. You also want to think about the whole approach, right? So you don't want to just screen the whole world and then, or your whole district and then don't do anything about it. So you need to really keep in mind, like, good screening needs to be followed by good evidence response to screening. And so that's important to keep in mind as well. In addition to this is that there is a lot of problems that, you know, some of the screeners or screening approaches have. Like, what are we screening for? Are we screening for reading comprehension or word reading or oral language or fluency? We also want to make sure that the screener matches the student population and, you know, involve all stakeholders in the screening process. So administrators, special educators, general educators, caregivers need to be on one page and need to understand what is the screening process and how screening different from, you know, diagnosis. There's, you know, a whole bunch of other things related to, you know, how you should screen. But a good approach is to find a good screener, a good evidence-based response to screening, and most importantly, have really good tier one instruction, really good curriculum implementation that addresses in the classroom already some of the important components that these kids are struggling with. So you don't want to have a disconnect between what they are getting in intervention, if they are getting intervention, and what they are getting in the classroom.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really great advice. And we'll link our listeners in the show notes to that website that you mentioned so that they'll have it right at the click of their fingers. We've also done a lot of conversation on this podcast of ensuring that we're serving students equitably. So even as you mentioned in the screening process or in the delivering of tier one instructions, what issues do you see or biases do you see that makes equity a challenge in this world of early reading?
Yeah. There's so much more to do. So we need to make sure that we have equity in the screening process, equity in the diagnostic process, equity in the access to intervention, that we, you know, embrace a multifactorial model, seeing that, you know, reading problems can come from, you know, different sources or causes. There is, you know, we need culturally responsible and appropriate and linguistically appropriate screeners. So there's a lot of work on including, English language learners, making sure that, you know, the screening process itself is, you know, matching with the population, including African American dialect speakers, equity in the awareness, right? So being aware that, you know, it's not just, you know, a problem in white rich kids. It's a problem that affects many, many different children. And it's a reading crisis we have in this country.
I know, you know, when we were talking, you also mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of things, and you just said it now, there's a lot we need to know. There's a lot of things that we know about early reading and early development, but there's a lot of things that we don't know yet. And maybe you can just talk about a few of those things that need more research or areas that we're just not sure of yet.
Yeah, so one part that we really focus on is on these early years, right? So a lot of people still think that learning to read starts with the first day of reading instructions, or that it starts miraculously, you know, the day, you know, they start preschool, etc. But there is a lot to learn. What actually are the precursors of phonological awareness? What are the precursors of rapid automatized naming, you know, what are the role of like gestures and babbling and some of these oral language skills? So that's definitely something. Also global focus, right? So there's a lot of languages where we still don't have assessment. For sure, we don't have screening. We don't even know what the precursors of reading are in these languages, and we don't have any intervention. So I think, you know, seeing this as a global issue will also be really, really important as like, you know, one of the, you know, next steps to focus on. We also need to, you know, work on our way of, you know, how we define, you know, dyslexia. And is it, you know, black, white issue, or is it a spectrum like the autism spectrum? So I think that's really important to tackle. And you know, how can we incorporate the knowledge that it is a spectrum into the diagnostic process? And then talk about co-occurrences, like there's a high rates of anxiety, high rates of depression, high rates of dyscalculia, which is a specific math disability, ADHD, developmental language disorder, autism spectrum disorder. What are, you know, why do we see these co-occurrences at rates that are much, much higher than if it would just, you know, occur by chance? And how do, you know, these processes develop in parallel? So we just started a study with Professor Daniel Ansari, where we are tracking language reading and math development over time from preschool to late elementary school, and see how does these processes co-develop, and you know what is different in kids who will struggle with reading only, or with math only, or with a combination of these two. I think, you know, a strong focus on wow. these multifactorial models and what are these protective factors will also be really important.
It sounds like in 2 years from now, we can come back and have a chat with you, and you'll have learned a lot more over the course of several more months of work.
Yeah, I think it will take a little bit longer than 2 years, but I like you being so optimistic.
it feels like there is there's so many more things that we could explore with you, but I'm wondering, as we sort of finish up some final thoughts here, if there's anything that you would like our listeners to take away, anything you really think is important for them to hear, any advice maybe?
Yeah, I think, well, we should not forget that the development of reading proficiency is a public health issue, right? So every child has the right to learn to read well. And literacy is a widely recognized determinant of health outcomes and is associated with so many indices of economic success and vocational, social, and academic success. There's so many implications for mental health. And so I think, you know, we just need to work together and make sure that, you know, the science of reading, which is a vast majority, a big body of research and not a philosophy and not a, you know, a isolated curriculum or isolated approach, is, you know, implemented in the classroom so that every child can experience the joy of learning to read.
Those are very wise words. Well, Dr. Gabb, it's just been an honor to have you again. Thank you so much for joining us. And for our listeners, we will link in some show notes for some resources for them. So thank you again. It's been such a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much for listening, and keep your feedback coming. Want to learn more? Be sure to stay connected by subscribing to your favorite podcast app and join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. And visit amplify.com to check out our brand new resource site, offering all the tools and tips you need to continue on your Science of Reading journey. Until next time, keep the hope, take the action, and stay in touch. Let's get our kids to love reading.